Try it again. Good morning, everyone. This is Joe Gray with Seven Generations Radio. And I'm here with John Christensen, my old friend, who has a Labor Beat show on Thursdays with John Case. And welcome, John. Let me make sure you're mic'd up here.
Good morning. Testing, 1, 2.
In the table. So well, anyway, I think we're available. I know we're available on the internet. So we're glad to be here. And, John, I wanted to kick off the show by reading something I wrote some time ago, stumbled across it, dusted it off, and edited it a little bit, and I want to read it for the folks, and it's called A Vision for a New Society. And it goes like this. In my vision of a new society, greed will no longer be sanctioned or admired. Wealth and property will be more equally distributed. Excessive profits and accumulation will be redistributed through graduated wealth and income taxation. People will invest in peace rather than war. The people on the planet will consume only at a level sustainable into the indefinite future. There will no longer be a greed-based economy. Nature's goods will be on an equal par with pharmaceuticals, and there will be no reward for lying about products. Nature will be cherished for its inherent value. Man will find his niche in nature. Communities will be largely self-sustaining, particularly in energy and food. This vision is based on a shift in the moral and ethical values of the society, accomplished through discussion and understanding. Ultimately, it depends on people adopting a new ethic because they believe it offers the greatest chance for man to succeed and survive on this planet. Drugs, both manufactured and natural, will be managed through cultural awareness, knowledge, and education. Harmful addiction will be treated as an illness rather than a criminal offense. Corporations, if they exist at all, will be answerable to the people and must show a net benefit to society. Everyone will have the opportunity to engage in meaningful work, and everyone will receive a minimum of a living wage. Environmental costs, including health costs and the cost of climate change or global warming, will be included in the cost of goods sold. A carbon tax will be added to the cost of all fossil fuels, and the conversion to alternative fuels will be a top priority. Poisons will no longer be applied in agricultural practice. Nature will be highly valued, and all degradation of nature will be added to the cost of whatever has caused the degradation. The benefits of technology and increased productivity will be shared with all people, including workers, rather than just the owners and top executives. Corporations will not be permitted to contribute to political campaigns or to lobby Congress or government. Political campaigns will be publicly financed. Private funding of elections will be severely limited so that no individual or organization can have an undue influence on the process or candidates. Policing of the public will be kept to the minimum necessary to protect them from serious harm, and civil liberties will be respected as a sacred right. Police will be trained in social empathy and nonviolent means of resolving public disputes and deterring crime. The first line of problem resolution will be by special teams skilled in nonviolent problem resolution. Criminal justice will be reformed so that crimes alleged to be committed by police will be handled through special prosecutors and courts that are removed from local influence or intimidation. The emphasis of our justice system will be protection of life and liberty. Prison time will be reserved for violent criminals who are a danger to society. Even there, people should be given the opportunity for rehabilitation and to leave prison when they are judged not to be a threat to society. People will value and respect diversity in race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation. People will live in contact with nature rather than isolated and insulated from it. Education will be free to those who pursue it, who wish to pursue it. Health care will be free to all, the cost being borne by the entire society. The money for this will come from the prison costs that are no longer necessary, reduction in military capacity, the carbon tax, and progressive taxation of income and wealth. The carbon tax could be revenue neutral or with a portion reserved for development of renewable, non-polluting fuel sources and technology. Peace will be vigorously pursued. Peace will be pursued by discussion of ideological differences and practices and good faith attempts to change offensive or threatening behavior. Countries will refrain from unwanted invasive attempts to remake other nations so that they constitute better markets for them, and from attempting to control another nation's resources. The departure from a greed-based economy and economic encroachment will make our country more trustworthy and less threatening in the world. This will reduce international tensions and make other countries more likely to enter into fair trade and peace negotiations with us. This is my vision.
Wonderful. That was one of the nicest things I've read in a long time, Joe.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
That's utopia. That's utopia. That's what we see. That's our vision. It's your vision, but it's all of our visions, except for a certain political party.
This is true. And I was just kind of chance encountered one of the political party platforms, and I will say it was Bernie Sanders, and I did notice an awful lot of similarity, and it was by chance. These things I've been thinking about for a long time, and I felt obligated to put it out there. So thanks everyone for listening, and our friend Sean O'Leary is going to be on the air with us shortly. He's going to call in about 11:15, and I know he's got some topics in mind, including things that are going on in West Virginia. He's out on the West Coast now, but I think he mentioned a couple of things like West Virginia tax reform proposals and a situation with coal, and particularly what's going on in China with respect to coal. And John, I know you're always active, and I think you went down south for a couple of days.
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had to go down to Charleston for the net metering task force, which was born by some bad legislation that passed last session, where they questioned the validity of net metering when they repealed the portfolio standard for renewable energy, where we had guidelines, even though they weren't real, even though they didn't have anything behind them. They were written down as to some kind of a policy statement, and it was a positive thing for all of the above, because we know this state is a coal and gas state, and there's very little room for anything else. But they put the net metering back in after they repealed the portfolio standard, and they changed the definition, and they added this word called cross-subsidization. And so this task force has been working all summer trying to decide, the reaches of cross-subsidization. I mean, it's crazy. We've got a panel of over a dozen people, and two of them or three or four of them are from industry, and the rest of them are stakeholders from environmental and energy efficiency, solar companies, Solar Choice from California. This is Solar Alliance, West Virginia Sun. I mean, there's a lot of stakeholders, and most of the people agree with me, and we all agree with each other, including the staff at the PSC, the Consumer Advocate Division. Heather Osborne is a wonderful advocate for renewables. And, we all agree, but the two power boys, the two power companies, APCO and First Energy, of course, they have a different idea about what net metering is and what renewable energy is. To them, it's a threat to their business model.
What is this change of wording trying to mean? And I do want to mention this is WSHC Shepherdstown, What is that change of wording intended for? Who put confusion. It in there? And what's
yeah,
the idea?
It's the Koch brothers. You know, it's the ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council. They have these think tanks, and they all throw their money in there with the Koch brothers, and they all decide ways to confuse the public. And that was one of the terms that they use that's very ambiguous. You know, it's cross-subsidization. When you think about it, it's just a really weird term, you know. But apparently they think that, and I say they, I mean the power companies, they think that, you know, solar energy advocates and solar energy system owners and customer generators is what the PSC calls them, are a threat to their business. And they're not. There are people that are have made a substantial investment in their own power, and they're trying to have clean power. You know, they feel offended by the fact that we have these huge smokestacks in and around West Virginia that our power companies own that emit all this terrible mercury and all this terrible particulates. And, you know, people breathe it, and that's why we have all these health problems around here. And, you know, they resent the fact that there's a new boy in town, there's a new company in town that wants to clean that up.
Clean air?
Clean air, yeah. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Cleaner water.
Cleaner water, right.
Definitely.
Because all that stuff falls out eventually.
Curbing global warming?
Absolutely.
I mean, and what I'm hearing is that these alternative energies, renewable energy forms, that's where the jobs are.
Absolutely.
And because a lot of the coal industry is highly mechanized. The workers are gone long time ago. I mean, there's just, relatively speaking, a very small number of workers left in this industry. It's a highly mechanized industry, and the money strictly goes to a few people at the top.
That's right. And, you know, the union workers are subjected to terrible working conditions, underground, breathing that dust, you know, because they don't wear their respirators because they say it's too confining, you know. If I worked in a coal mine, I'd be wearing a respirator. I don't care what, but apparently down underground, the coal miners, you know, kind of have this brotherhood going because they're working such terrible conditions all the time that they all decided, you know, pretty much equilaterally, unilaterally, I should say, that they don't need to wear the respirators. And meanwhile, it's almost a given that they're going to get the black lung. You know, they have very high incidence of black lung.
That's
what a tough way to go, too.
Terrible legacy.
It is.
John, I understand one of your old friends was visiting Lewisburg over the weekend or last couple of days.
Yeah, it was Thursday. On my way down to Charleston, I thought I'd stop in at the Greenbrier and join a protest against Dick Cheney, who has a new book out called Exceptionalism or something to that effect. And he had his daughter with him, and they're on a tour. They're on a book tour, and the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce, Steve Roberts, I believe is the gentleman's name, is the head of that, decided that it was in the best interest of his organization, which, you know, covers all of West Virginia. Just about every county and every region has a Chamber of Commerce, to invite Dick Cheney, who a lot of us think is a war criminal.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, most of us think that with his torture, with his treason, outing Valerie Plame, and I mean, all these instances where he was just very, very divisive and not democratic at all. I mean, they ran the thing like a dictatorship, and they started that war illegally.
And we have that legacy continues today with the huge surge of refugees, which is a result of continuing war in the Middle East, all triggered back in the Cheney era.
Right. And a lot of people thought Cheney was the real president because, you know, he's just so devious. And how could George be handling it? Because it's way over his head.
But
that's the understatement of the year.
Look, Sean, go ahead, please.
Oh, Hi, Joe. No, it's just real great to talk to you, and thanks for letting me come on. No, there were just a couple of things this week that I thought were interesting. I heard just a minute ago you were talking about Dick Cheney and his appearance at the Chamber of Commerce conference in White Sulphur Springs. But the other thing I wanted to mention is they had another guest at the conference, another speaker. I don't know if you had mentioned Arthur Laffer.
Right, right. I meant to mention that, but I held it for you.
No, because Arthur Laffer, of course, is the economist who became famous during the Reagan administration and basically gave us the concept of supply-side economics. And what was both, frankly, funny, but also pretty worrying was that while the Chamber of Commerce had Dick Cheney advising them on matters of national security, they had Arthur Laffer advising them on issues of economics.
That's and a laffer.
Of course,
that's a laffer.
But I'm afraid that, unlike Cheney, I don't think the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce is going to do anything that will appreciably affect national security one way or the other. On the other hand, they do have the power and they do have the influence to have a great deal to say about what happens with tax policy in West Virginia. And what seems to be coming out of White Sulphur Springs, frankly, is pretty worrying. Because basically the prescription that Laffer laid down at White Sulphur Springs is that the state should cut income taxes for upper-income taxpayers and, believe it or not, raise them for lower-income taxpayers.
Where have we heard this before?
In fact, if you go to the website for the Charleston Now Gazette and Mail, the columnist David Gutman had a story about this. And I have to say, I've got to give Gutman credit because he's one of the few journalists in West Virginia who actually had the temerity to put Laffer's case in context. And the context of which I'm referring to, of course, is that Laffer is one of the architects of the great tax-cutting experience in Kansas that has plunged that state into an abysmal crisis in which it cut taxes, caused massive state budget deficits without triggering any of the economic growth that Laffer claimed would come about. And, of course, that follows on the heels of Laffer, 4 or 5 years ago, famously predicting that the various stimulus activities that the federal government was undertaking and that the Fed was undertaking would precipitate, skyrocketing interest rates and inflation here. He's a man who profoundly does not understand economics. And given his track record, which is there for all to see just how badly he has missed what has happened, not just for the last 6 years, but for about the last 30, it's truly distressing that the folks at the Chamber of Commerce, whose guests, by the way, included one of the chairmen of the Tax Reform Committee in the House of Delegates and also the Republican nominee for governor, were there to hear him. And those two fellows spoke very admiringly of Laffer and even said that his proposals for cutting upper-tier income taxes and raising them on lower-tier are very likely to find their way out of the Tax Reform Committee and into proposals for the state.
Sean, are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Well, I thought all this was debunked by Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. And we have so much evidence now that these kind of policies are a gross failure. We're practically at the point where the 1%, I saw the prediction, the 1% are going to have more wealth than the 99% by 2016.
So it's getting worse every day.
How can they continue to foster these kind of policies? These are what they call economists, but these people do not see the forest for the trees.
Well, we're living in. The scary thing to me about this, Joe, is that we're almost living in a post-factual world with some of our political leaders. I mean, folks like Arthur Laffer can only exist as economists in a world where they're basically politicians' economists.
Right.
Arthur Laffer has little, if any, credibility whatsoever within the economic profession. But because he delivers a message that's amenable to the preconceptions and the preferences of a certain class of people who have a lot of money to help promulgate his views and advertise them and, frankly, misrepresent the consequences of them, he's still part of the conversation politically. He's part of the discourse. And the fact that, you know, folks like gubernatorial candidates in West Virginia not only take this guy seriously, but go so far as to say that, you know, his views have been proven out by history, which, of course, is the exact opposite of the truth, is frankly just plain frightening. And it goes to the issue of the fact that if you can buy a big enough megaphone, you can make, you can tell the greatest lie and make it stick. And to a large degree, that sadly seems to be what's happening.
You know, my father, the man's still alive, remarkably, at the age of 96 and doing quite well. But one of the things that he taught me when I was a kid was that old trees, when they're about to die, put out a lot of seed, particularly the palm trees. And I think this is what we have is the dying gasps of, in this post-factual world, of people that clinging to the past desperately. I think these are the last gasps. I hope they are.
Well, I hope that's all it is, and I hope in their dying clutch and their dying gasps, they don't do too much damage to the rest of us in the process. Because, you know, to your point, Joe, we're seeing exactly the same thing on the whole issue of climate change, too, where just like you have Arthur Laffer in economics, who basically exist only for propaganda purposes as a sort of hired intellectual to give a veneer of respectability to views that no longer hold up factually. By the same token, you have a class of just a very few climate scientists who largely are on industry payrolls who try to provide a veneer of respectability to climate change denial. And in both cases, you know, these are people that have political followings and supporters who are still, despite the overwhelming body of evidence, in a position to do a great deal of damage.
Yeah, now, you said intellectuals, but wouldn't it be better to call him just a propagandist?
Well, at this point, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, the problem is that he can be and is positioned as a credible intellectual.
Okay.
A credible expert. In Laffer's case, as an economist, and in the case of just a few, and they are climate scientists, as experts, as part of the scientific mainstream, when in fact they're complete outliers. And, you know, and again, there are people who are willing to magnify their voices because the Koch brothers and others, who give them a much greater voice in public discourse than they ever have in scientific discourse.
Well, this is an economic model that has largely failed. I mean, we have many benefits from the capitalist free market system. But in my view, it's run its course. It's basically turned against us. It was a model that helped move us into an era where we had many things. We could feed many people. The population of the earth was able to multiply from 1 billion to 7 billion over the course of 200 years, largely on the basis of coal and the free enterprise economic system. But at this point, this system has turned on us, and it has gravitated into a system that has built a new aristocracy and a new direction of slavery, basically, for the working class people. And they're being oppressed and pushed lower and lower because anything that does not represent profit does not have any value, such as the environment has no value because it does not have a dollar label on it. The same thing with the unemployed. They have no value because there is no profit associated with them. And therefore, this model is very defective. And until we put dollar signs on all of these things that currently miss them, this model just is not going to work for us.
Well, I can go about halfway with you on that. I actually, believe it or not, I'm a fairly big believer in markets, but in regulated ones, ones in which, because I do think there are some things that markets do very well. It's just that whereas I think people who come from the very conservative or libertarian perspectives tend to view markets, you know, the proverbial invisible end, as basically being the end of God, you know, I tend to view markets as a tool to be used appropriately. And when it's not appropriate, you don't use it or you limit its use. And, you know, we have right now out here, I'm in Seattle right now, and we have a really interesting issue, a battle going on out there politically that I'd like to hear your views on. There's a proposal in Washington right now having to do with carbon emissions, and specifically, there is a proposed law that would tax carbon emissions at a rate of about $25 per ton emitted. And I think that's very much in line with some of the things that I know you suggested that we need to do, because that's basically a tax to try to capture some of the collateral damage, the externalities associated with emitting carbon. And I support this too. I think it's a great idea. What's interesting, though, is that there's a divide within the environmental community about this, because the proceeds from that tax under the bill that's been proposed would largely go toward reducing Washington State's sales tax, which is a very high sales tax. Washington has one of the most regressive tax systems in the country. And so the benefits would go toward, frankly, by and large, lower-income people who pay a much greater percentage of their incomes in the sales tax. Now, the divide, though, that it's created in the environmental community is that while there are some people like me who support this, who view it as doing two good things, one is discouraging carbon emissions while at the same time making the tax system more progressive, there are others who are more focused on environmental issues who say, first of all, that any money that's derived from this tax should go back into improving the environment in other ways as well. And secondly, who are also bothered by, in principle, by the use of a taxing system, which in a sense gives sanction to carbon-emitting fuels. And so, again, from my perspective, as a believer in markets that need to be, that can be very valuable in what they do, but also need to be regulated and used, applied only where appropriate, I think this is a great idea, personally. But well, I'd be curious to see how that concept fits in with what you think.
Well, I agree with you. What you said about markets, I'm not against markets. I'm not against the free enterprise system. But I am against... I think there's a line between competition and greed, and the benefits of competition versus the hoarding and the greed and the consuming mentality, the take-all mentality. And that's where it's an ethical and a moral issue. And you cannot, in my view, just turn the markets loose. As you said, they need to be regulated. And what you're talking about is a regulation that basically puts a price on the degradation of the environment. And that's the same thing I'm talking about. Markets will work better when some of the things that are not priced now, that are excluded from the pricing system are brought into it, and there you're putting a price tag on environmental degradation. That's the right way to go, and that means that people will shift to other sources of energy that do not degrade the environment to this extent. And now, what do you do with the money? Okay, I agree with you about the regressiveness of a sales tax and the fact that a shift of that nature to ease that regressive nature, that is a good thing to do. You know, a lot of the formulas for carbon tax have been such that it is revenue neutral, where it is distributed evenly to the populace. Okay, that's one way to go. I think getting rid of a regressive sales tax to some extent, I think you're getting a double benefit out of that. Should some of the money go to alternative fuel research and support? I would agree with that. If that goes to maybe they could come up with a 25% that would go that way, and the rest of it goes to ease the sales tax. I'm totally with that.
Well, and in fairness to the folks who are proposing it, they actually do have that. The bulk of the money would go toward reducing the sales tax, but there actually is a portion, and I'm not sure of the percentage, that would do just what you suggested.
I think we're on the same page on that one. John, what are your feelings on it?
Yeah, I agree with you. Couldn't agree with you more. But it's kind of disgusting when you consider that all the business leaders in West Virginia, getting off the Washington State for now, all the business leaders and all the political leaders show up at the Greenbrier, which is one of the most opulent hotels in the world. I mean, it is truly a luxury hotel. And, you know, they sit there and talk about right to work. You know, I mean, that was a big topic of discussion during this symposium for several days. And so a group of citizens got together and decided to protest it. And my goodness, they threw some people in jail because they stepped off the sidewalk. They stepped on the grass. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I know. I believe you. I mean, I think, and this goes back to when, you know, I returned to West Virginia, having been away for about 20 years. And one of the reasons that I came back, and one of the reasons that I started writing about issues like this in West Virginia, is because public discourse in West Virginia, meaning the messages, what we hear from candidates running for office, but also from much of the news media in West Virginia, is incredibly narrow-banded and incredibly prejudicial. It's almost inconceivable in many other places the degree to which there's almost monochromatic conversation in West Virginia about what's good, what's bad, and the degree to which, the extent to which people will go to silence voices that at all disagree with that message.
Yeah, and it's a bully mentality too.
It is.
Yeah, they bully.
It
and
absolutely
and
is.
The gentleman, and I say that, I use that term loosely, but he owns the Greenbrier, is running for governor. I mean, is this real? I mean, can this really happen where a guy that was a Republican his whole life suddenly changes parties and becomes a Democrat at the urging of Joe Manchin? And, you know, he's the ringleader behind the whole thing. And he's going to have, you know, unlimited amounts of funds to spend on the campaign.
There seems to be a certain portion of the populace that votes against their own self-interest. And I'm wondering, why is that so? Why does it continue to be the case?
Well, I'll take a run at that. And first of all, to your point, Joe, I would refer people to a book that came out now, golly, I'll bet it's been 7 or 8 years ago, called What's the Matter with Kansas? And it was written by, I can't remember the fellow's first name, his last name is Frank, F-R-A-N-K. And he asked exactly that question. why do people in Kansas, which is a largely middle-class state, vote so consistently Republican, which meant economically against their own interests? And, you know, that's the question you're asking now of West Virginia. I don't know the answer in Kansas, but I will tell you this. The propaganda that we were talking about, or what you, JB, called propaganda a minute ago, I think has largely sunk in. And, you know, around the conference at the Greenbrier, I don't know if you saw this, but prior to the conference, a polling organization did a poll in West Virginia asking about West Virginians' views on a number of issues, the environment and jobs and other things. And one of the fascinating aspects of that poll was how different West Virginians' perceptions are and positions are on those issues as compared to those of the United States as a whole. And I think that's where you see the acid difference. People in West Virginia, by and large, believe that the coal industry and this, not only the survival, but the thriving of the coal industry are central to the to people, communities, and individuals in West Virginia being able to thrive. It's wrong, but they believe it.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous because the coal industry has actually brought West Virginia down to where they are, and they're never going to recover unless they change their strategy. You know, unless they completely change their system to where they allow more input from outside forces instead of just one, you know, the fossil fuel industry, until they allow more people to have a seat at the table, they're not going to ever, you know, benefit from this new economy that we're having, that many states are enjoying now.
Yeah, but you know, JB, how many voices that are delivering the message that you just did, how many voices are there that the average West Virginian hears that says what you just said?
Very few. I mean, here at the show we have several, but here at this station, but you're right, it's very few and far between.
I mean, and if you talk to, you know, folks, especially downstate in West Virginia, I mean, you realize that by and large, people don't realize how out of depth their views are with those of the country as a whole on many issues. People believe in West Virginia that, for instance, that the bulk of citizens, that the bulk of consumers want more coal energy in order to keep their electric rates down. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Just last week, the Pew Trusts came out with a survey that looked at attitudes toward means of generating power. And by a 2-to-1 margin, American voters want the federal government to de-emphasize, to reduce the focus on coal. I think it's fair to say that most West Virginians, and by the way, West Virginians were exactly the reverse of that. And I think it's fair to say that most West Virginians would be astonished to hear that consumers, by 2-to-1, want to see less coal used. And because it ultimately goes back to the coal industry's greatest barrier to making a comeback. And it isn't the EPA, and arguably it isn't even natural gas. Because what's happening now, in addition to the fact that coal is not that doesn't offer that much of a price advantage, the next biggest reason that new coal-fired power plants aren't being built is because people don't want them. They don't want to live next to them. They certainly don't want to live downstream from them. And for that reason, not the EPA. Coal, you know, of course, is not going to make a comeback, but I think by and large, people in West Virginia have no conception of just how negatively people view coal and how fearful they are of the consequences of burning it.
Well, Sean, I think I sense that a lot of talk radio that's on the other side of the political spectrum, they play to fear, anger, paranoia. These are a lot of gut issues, anti-intellectualism, fear of the outside coming in, regulating you, changing your life. All of this is fear-based stuff. And I think they've learned to tap into something that gives a visceral reaction. It's not an intellectual reaction. And they've learned that this is something, a very powerful tool. And they play up to this tool. They play up to this fear and this visceral type of reaction.
Well, and yeah, to your point, going back to the top of this conversation, I mean, you know, Arthur Laffer has made his reputation basically predicting disaster, of course, unless his preferred policies are sent. I mean, it's one thing to say that this is a better way as opposed to another way, but you're right, fear-mongering is central to much of the dialogue that goes on, and in no area more so than with respect to coal and the environment in West Virginia.
Yeah, and you know, we have one major news source in West Virginia, Metro News, and they have the one talk show for the whole state, and it's Hoppy Kirchival, and he is totally, you know, owned by the fossil industry. He's owned. You know, his boss is John Racy, who owns the station, owns the network.
Sure.
And I mean, that guy's just about as coal as can be. And I argue with him all the time. I send Hoppy emails. I don't necessarily want to get on the air with him, but I've been on his show several times. And I point out these gross differences between, you know, what other states do and what we do. And he just dismisses it as, oh, you know, we're not like the other states, you know. But my question would be, why not? You know, why can't we be better than what we are? Why can't we be the best state in the country? If we changed a few laws, we could become the e-topia. You know, I mean, this could be the destination for people that want to hike and boat and climb rocks and you know, do all kinds of outdoor activity that they can't do in their states.
And be self-sustaining in food and energy.
Yeah, and we have a long way to go in that, Joe, because as you know, West Virginia only grows 10% of their food. 10%. That's it. The rest of it comes from outside. It's just crazy.
Which is astonishing in a very rural state. You're right.
Yeah, but I mean, it's changing a little bit. I mean, they've really put an emphasis on the farmers markets and organic gardening and organic, you know, getting into the markets, and really, it's much better than it was. It's increased probably double in the last 5 years. But you know, I mean, it has to come from the top. I mean, all the stuff that we're seeing that's positive comes from the bottom, you know, and, you know, it really needs some big pockets to rain down on the 99% and to change the laws. I mean, people vote. People got to get out and vote. They didn't vote last time. You know, only 30% people voted, and you can't improve with that, with those type of numbers.
No, you can't. I mean, I would say, you know, personally, that it does go back to the whole issue of public discourse, because, I mean, the reality is that most people get their news and therefore their understanding of issues from, you know, what they hear on radio, some degree what they read in newspapers, certainly what they see on TV. And in West Virginia, we live in a media environment in which the deck, not just the editorial, or not just the opinion or editorial deck, but even the way in which the news is reported, is frankly stacked against alternative opinions. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but there's a blog called Alternative Wheeling. And I don't even know who's behind it. I'm not sure who does it. But it's a Wheeling-based blog that basically comments on the Wheeling News Register and Intelligencer newspapers and the way in which they present the news. And this is relevant, by the way, because these are Ogden newspapers, and of course the Ogden family also owns the Martinsburg Journal. They're part of the same editorial family.
Ogden.
What the Wheeling Alternative does frequently, and it's very cute and it's very funny, is that they compare AP wire service stories and the way in which those stories are written and distributed by the AP to the way in which they're edited for presentation in the Whelan newspapers. And the differences are astonishing because you can see that the AP pieces are being edited not just to achieve for state reasons, but they're being edited also to manipulate what is being said and the perspective.
I could write a message for you.
And, you know, when you said, as you were mentioning this, alternative Wheeling, you hadn't even said anything about Martinsburg, but the Martinsburg Journal would be a perfect one to have a counterpart alternative version of the news. I mean, that's just perfect because, I mean, I go back to when I read an article that they had couple of years ago. It was actually a letter to the editor about the benefits of greed. It just blew my mind. I mean, and this was totally bought by the people that read and follow that that medium. But Sean, before we lose you here, I wanted to ask you that you had another item you mentioned in your email to me, and that was about what's going on in China with respect to carbon reduction. Could you speak about that?
Oh, yeah. This is just a quick one, but I think it's an important one. And this, by the way, speaks to the issue we were just talking about, of folks in West Virginia simply not being aware of something because West Virginia media doesn't report it. I think you may remember that about a year and a half ago, President Obama entered into an agreement with the Chinese to reduce carbon emissions. And, of course, you know, Congressman David McKinley from West Virginia's 1st District, who's a pretty rabid climate change denialist, went absolutely ballistic. And among his criticisms was that it's ridiculous for the U.S. to, in his terms, put itself at a great economic disadvantage by restricting the use of coal while countries like China are free to go ahead and pursue burning coal and thereby, you know, gain what he argues is great economic advantage by doing so. And the criticism of that particular agreement was that China would not have to reduce emissions until the year 2030 while we would have to start doing it now. What's interesting, of course, is that in the last 2 years in particular, China has actually cracked down on the use of coal to the point that it is now reducing its overall consumption of coal.
Sure.
Not just, I mean, they're not only slowing down the growth, they've actually reversed it now. And they are retiring coal-fired power plants. They're making immense, immense changes. And what's fascinating about this is that, of course, this hardly ever gets reported in West Virginia. What's fascinating about it, though, are the reasons for which they're doing it. And that is, Joe, I've got to give credit to you, this goes back to a point that you often make, and that is all the externalities, those consequences of burning coal. The great irony of this is that in China, where the government controls the power-generating industry and is heavily involved in the coal mines, the costs that are externalized in the United States, where neither the coal mining companies nor the power-generating companies have to deal with the economic and health consequences of burning coal, in China, the government does. They're the sole provider of health care. They have to live with and they have to pay for the consequences of burning coal. And that's why in China they are so aggressive in reducing the use of coal, because they can no longer live with, they can no longer afford those consequences.
That's interesting, coming out of the same pocket.
Well, yeah, and that's the great irony of this, because, you know, while the David McKinleys of the world criticize that environmental agreement on the grounds that it doesn't require the Chinese to do things, he should actually take comfort in this, because the Chinese are reducing their consumption of coal for a reason that he, as a presumed free marketer, should really appreciate. And that is, it's in their economic self-interest to do so.
I think there's a selective application of news, selective memory, too easily ignored.
Yeah. So that was just the point that I wanted to make, though, is that the world is changing. It's a very different place. And that, yes, when you do recognize the total spectrum of the economic consequences of burning coal, it frankly doesn't make sense.
Right, we're going to pay the price. Either you pay it here, you pay it somewhere else. But the costs need to be assigned to the sources and to the production capacities that are causing these costs to be incurred. So, Sean, it's been great having you on. I'm sorry we had a little technical glitches, but we somehow overcame them, which is rather remarkable. With the help of JB here, we finagled how to run a cell phone through the board. We're all good. So,
hey, I'll be coming out the West Coast in October, man. Maybe we can run into each other.
No, you email me, call me, do something. We have to get together.
Yeah, that'd be great. Hey, thanks a lot for calling in.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, Sean.
Bye-bye.
Nice having you. Bye-bye. And that was our friend Sean O'Leary calling in from the West Coast, a very knowledgeable person in economics and politics about the state of West Virginia and the world. And JB, you have any closing comments?
Well, while we were talking to Sean, I got a call from a good friend of mine down in Lewisburg who wanted to weigh in on the protest, but we just ran out of time.
And wires,
yeah. But it was certainly my pleasure to come on your show, Joe. And you know, anytime you want me to come on, I'd be happy to. I love it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, JB, and I certainly will have you back. And that concludes our show for the day. You've been listening to Seven Generations Radio. We'll be back, 2 weeks from today. So be looking forward to spending some time with you. Take care, and have a great week. Bye bye.